Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio, and don't touch that dial, because this week on QSO, it's Steve Mendelson, W2ML, and Steve received the 2004 DeForest Audion Gold Medal for contributions to the wireless art and bringing the sounds of history to America and for advancing audio technology. Steve is also in charge of the very largest amateur radio-assisted marathon in the world, and he'll be joining us on QSO coming right up. Also, Bob Interbitzen, NQ1R. He's the marketing manager for the ARRL. He'll be joining us as well, so stay tuned for QSO. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas, TW2010, and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these, if not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. TransWorldAntennas.com. Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, TedRandall.com or QSORadioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello, tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month. And we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air. But don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be.
Our guest is Steve Mendelson, W2ML. And Steve is in charge of and affiliated with a project here that we want to talk about, which is really intriguing. And I want to say hello, Steve. How are you doing today?
Oh, just enjoying a cold, rainy day during our one-week run-up to a little thing called the New York City Marathon, just a small get-together.
Yeah, well, you want to tell us a little bit about that. Steve started telling me a story, which I had never heard, and I did not know this. And it's very interesting because he was talking about the fact that hams or ham radio operators either adopt a technology or they invent it. And I really had never thought of that. Those putting it in those words are I guess I want to say really enlightening. But tell us the story behind TCP/IP. I think this is really amazing.
Well, once upon a time, amateur radio operators used data transmission, which they called packet radio. It was an interesting concept that you could actually encode certain letters or sentences or groups of sentences and send them over the air without wires. Now, we all know you can't send pictures or data over the air without wires, so they invented it. Phil Karn, K9NA, and Eric Skase in PICTU. Phil Karn, KA9Q, and Eric Skase, M3NA, put together a suite of protocols that they called Terminal Control Program using Internet Protocol, otherwise known as TCP/IP. From that grew all kinds of ability to send, I'm told, pictures and voice over the wires and Personally, I don't believe it. As a matter of fact, I was talking to my daughter on Skype last night, reminding her that you can't send pictures over the wires either. But in point of fact, amateur radio operators look at technologies, whether they're commercial or whether they're their own invention, and they use them to look forward. Many of the things that we enjoy in the commercial world were invented by hams. And many of the people who are longtime broadcasters have ham radio in their background as well, as did my friend, the gentleman I gave the test to, a man named Walter Cronkite, who liked to remind people that if he had ever gone to college and completed his college, he probably would have made a success of himself.
Oh yeah, I've heard the story told, and that was just that's especially the way you folks pulled the code test on him, you know. And you know, I think, you know, back in that time there was a lot of angst and anxiety about taking the code test. I think that kept a lot of people away, and really, it was not nearly as difficult as they had envisioned it to be. But there's something about, I think, being with a group of other people and somebody sending you the code, and it bothers some folks. You know, they're not like myself, somebody who can't be embarrassed easily. Okay, they're a bit shy about it, and.
Well, while they may be shy about it, my fondest recollection is I used to travel with CBS News. I was an engineer with CBS's news department. And I went to Germany for an economic summit, and I was standing and talking with an engineer from one of the German television stations. I'm talking English, he's talking English, then we lapsed into German, which I had learned in high school and had a chance to sharpen up. And then I asked him what other languages he spoke, and he spoke a little bit of Latin, and I asked why he wasn't a ham, and he said, "The Morse code, are you crazy? You can't learn that." And I said, "Let me understand this. You were able to learn three different languages, but Morse code, which consists, unless it's changed lately, of nothing more than dots and dashes, is impossible." Yeah, it is very hard to learn Morse code in German. And I explained to him that Morse code was the same the world over. And once you start hearing it, after a while, you just hear whole letters. You don't hear T or H or E. You hear da. 2 years later, I worked him on the air. It is the universal language, and I think now that people don't have to learn it, they've come to appreciate that it is an art form, much in the way that speaking ancient Latin or Greek is. And so more and more hams, many of whom absolutely could never learn it to upgrade, are simply learning it for their own enjoyment. Something I really do enjoy.
Well, you know, we were set up doing a live broadcast at the Huntsville Ham Fest. This has been back, I guess, 2 years ago. We were right next door to Vibroplex. They were in the booth next to us. And I got to talking to those guys, and they said, you know, since the code restriction has gone away, or the code element as part of the test has gone away, their sales are up. They're way up. They were selling more bugs and keys and paddles than you could shake a stick at. And then I was talking to Gordon West, and Gordon said that his code teaching CDs and whatnot had the sales on those things had just gone through the roof. He was selling a lot more now than he was when the code was a requirement. So this is kind of a strange turn, don't you think? I mean,
No, I don't. I think it's part of the human condition. When I tell people that I use Morse code, they look at me and say, "Oh, isn't that old?" And I just smile, and I have kind of a patented saying. I remind them that in an age of nuclear ships, people still sail with sailboats and canoes. And I remind them that in an age of cars with 300 and 400 horsepower under the hood, people still ride individual horses. It is part of the human condition to look at the simpler things, the simpler times of life, and enjoy little pieces of them in the middle of our hurried existence today. What? And so the Morse code has fallen very much into that niche. It's what you do to enjoy yourself. It's the same as going out and rowing, which you don't have to do because there are ocean liners that can go far faster. But as individual human beings, we like to do things that many, many people did years and years and years ago, and we enjoy them.
Well, I guess that also addresses the subject of folks that are using the AM mode. I tune by and I listen to some of those guys talking, and they're amazing. I mean, these fellas are really into this. I mean, they've gone in and replaced the caps inside of these transmitters, and they're using the different microphones and whatnot. And you listen to them talk, and it's really quite amazing. I think I've got a decent speaker system connected up to the radio, and it sounds like they're sitting right next to you. Not that there's anything wrong with sideband, but they've really made an art form out of this. I mean, they really have studied it, and they really enjoy it.
And why? I'm surprised that you're surprised. Ham radio is not a hobby. One of the things I learned in my 12 years as ARRL Hudson Division Director is that ham radio is really 25 identifiable hobbies, or I should say sub-hobbies, under a single umbrella. We have people that build transmitters and tweak them to the nth degree. We have people that can do 45 and 50 words a minute of Morse code. We have people that are experts in contesting, in antenna design. Why then should you be surprised that those people who enjoy AM want to make it sound like an AM transmitter with broadcast quality? On the contrary, I see that as just the same as the guy that's up there adjusting the spacing on his five-element beam when he's trying to get another quarter of a dB out of it.
Well, that's just the nature of hams. The one fellow I was listening to one night, and he's got a homebrew AM transmitter with PDM modulation on it, and that thing really sounded good. And he was talking about it and this other project that he was making, and it was really refreshing to hear these guys, because they were just totally captivated by what they were doing. And I'll tell you something else that's weird, too. Did you remember, when you talk about going back and doing things simpler and a nostalgic thing, do you remember the old little Amico transmitter kits?
Oh, the Amico 6 and 2, they were built on a copper-colored chassis, and the gentleman that was Amico lived in Long Island, somewhere around Hillside. No, I don't remember them at all.
Okay. Anyways, the little CW transmitters, I think they sold for somewhere around maybe $19, and maybe they went up to $29 later or something like that. But I remember I built several of them, and I put a couple of them on the air. And then, of course, I built CW transmitters from scratch. But they were really, that was kind of a cool thing, you know. And you sit there with this little transmitter, and you're making contacts all over the place and collecting QSL cards. And of course, it was kind of cool to do. And I notice on eBay, if you can find one of those Amico transmitters, those things, the price tag on them is absolutely through the roof. I don't know the last one I saw. I think the auction ended at like $300. Somebody paid $300 for that thing.
Oh, my.
And I thought, but you see, there you go. There is that that love of the past and the nostalgia part of it.
Well, I was at a flea market out on Long Island just this past weekend, and there were some gentlemen there with a couple of Collins KWM2s, and I watched people walk by them, primarily older hams, walk by and just stand and look, and you could see the past right in their eyes, and you could see them thinking about all the things they did when those radios were new. And what happens is they buy these things because, in a way, they're kind of buying a piece of their childhood. They're buying a radio that they couldn't afford as a kid, but they can afford it now. And what they hear coming out of the speaker has nothing to do with what's being transmitted. They hear all of the days that they stood next to their friend's KWM2 and wondered at how good it sounded. They think about all of the people they knew that had Collins gear and how they were the upper crust of ham radio. And they're buying back a little bit of their childhood when they do that. And to me, it's wonderful to see. I've been a ham for 51 years, and I'm always amazed, not at the hardware, but the minds of the people that invent the hardware, that modify the hardware, that use the hardware in contests, that use it for public service, that use it for all of the things. Hams are very unique individuals.
You know, and I guess the thing of it is one thing that I found about the hobby early on when I was very young, and that is that hams tend are, how would I say, they don't, it's not that they tend to, they just are fraternal in nature. In other words, you have the term Elmer, it's odd because people outside of the amateur radio arena don't have any idea or clue what that means. But you have the term Elmer, but it goes even beyond Elmer. It really is quite a fraternity. So I think that, you know, when you're talking about a person looking at an old rig, it might be a, you know, when I was a kid, the first demonstration of ham radio I saw was a fellow in Detroit by the name of Nelson Cosby. And he had a Heathkit Marauder, a Hallicrafters SX-101, and a Homebrew 813 linear amplifier. And I had never seen amateur radio operate before. I'd heard about it, read about it, saw pictures, but never saw it. And I stepped into his basement, and of course, as a kid, this was like looking at a spaceship, and might as well have been a spaceship. And he got on 20 meters on with a beam antenna and talked to a guy in Colorado, you know, and that's all it took for me. I mean, I saw that, and I said, oh, my goodness, you know, this is... But when you think about the older equipment, all that stuff sits there in your mind. And maybe it gets bigger than life. I don't know. But it's so every time I see a Heathkit Marauder, I do exactly the same thing you're talking about. That whole period of time runs back through my mind again, almost like a reel of film, you know, that you're showing on a screen.
Well, I want to talk to one thing that you first expressed, and that was the Elmering concept and how amateur radio operators are fraternal. In 1978, I was fortunate enough to be the pool engineer on President Jimmy Carter's trip to Africa. We went to Liberia, and then I was to go to Nigeria. Or we went to Nigeria, rather, and then I was to go to Liberia. And one of the things that... one of the wonderful things that happened was that I was the QSL manager for Walcott Benjamin, EL2BA. Ben said they needed two 100-foot lengths of coax, of RG8, for the Liberian National Station. And he asked if we had some, and of course we have thousands of feet of it, and he asked would it be possible to bring some in. So I was to go up the day before President Carter arrived. So I have these two huge coils of RG8 on my shoulder. We land at Roberts Field. I walk down the ramp into their reception area. And there are two gentlemen there from the Army with guns. They see me coming down the ramp. And all of a sudden, the guns come off their shoulder. And they ask me, was I Steve Mendelson? Yes. One of them said, you're under arrest. Come with us. We wait for my bag to come down off the baggage cart. I take the bag. They ask for my passport. And they go around the very, very long passport line to an official window, shove the passport in, and say, this gentleman is coming with us. The man at passport control stamps the passport. I'm wondering, what in God's name is going on? I walked out of the airport at the point of the bayonet that was on the gun, and there is a military Jeep with a 50 cal mounted on it, and in back of it, a black Mercedes sedan. We walk up, and one of them tells me to stop. The windows to the Mercedes come down. The L2BA says, welcome to Liberia. It was the only way we could get the coax through without having to pay duty. And everybody, including Sewell Brewer, who was the head of their FCC, and the two Army guys, were all hams.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's how we got the coax into Liberia.
Well, it's a good thing you had a good, strong heart in the process. I think if I would have been greeted by that and said, you're under arrest, I don't know what I would have done. I don't know. I wonder what was racing through your mind at that point.
Well, first of all, I knew that following very closely behind me were four Secret Service agents. And if anything were to happen, I knew I could just turn around because they were waiting on the line themselves. I could turn around and ask them to give me a hand. But maybe a sixth sense or the fact that we are a fraternity that is worldwide. We as hams, time and again, go out of our way to help each other, no matter what country we're in. And my travels with CBS, the 21 years I was with CBS News, are replete with incidents where I was in another country. Ham radio suddenly gave me a huge group of friends that enabled me to do many, many things that I had that most people could never, ever do. You always have a friend if you have a ham radio license or a call sign badge or some piece of indication with you, a call sign hat, a little badge. And if you walk through customs or if you walk through an airport or if you walk through any of the technical districts, there's always a ham that walks up and introduces themselves and says, welcome to wherever you are. We are an incredibly, incredibly unique fraternity in that regard.
Well, I know it's interesting if you're on the HF bands for any length of time, the friendships that you develop over the air. And then as you travel across the country for any reason whatsoever, it's always neat because there's almost somebody in every city, you know, that you can look up, somebody that you've talked to years ago, and it's, you know, it's like old home week. In other words, these people aren't strangers.
Instant friends. I have a TS-440 that during the Bush administration traveled more places. I had a friend that was in the White House press office, didn't have his own mobile rig, and I used to ship him my mobile rig. I brought it to our local airport, Newark Airport, and there was always somebody there that was able to take it down to Washington, and it traveled the world. And everywhere it went, I had he made sure that I got a QSL from whatever country that he filled out. And it went to something like 19 countries. The rig has more countries for DXCC than I used to have.
Well, how do you find, do you working for ABC, and you want to tell the folks a little bit about what you do professionally. I was going to say, how do you find time?
Well, life is filled with exciting adventure for me. It always has been. I've been incredibly fortunate that the reason I was chosen by CBS News to go on all those trips was because the executive producer at the time, a wonderful man named Tony Brunton, was KA1HI. And he would not travel out of the country unless he had a ham radio operator with him, because we as a group of people tend to be very inventive in the way we do things. I mentioned the Carter trip to Nigeria. That was the first actual CBS ENG remote. The press was traveling alongside the president's yacht, President Obasanjo's yacht with President Carter aboard, and they needed a way to do reports, live reports. Well, as you might imagine, back in the 1970s, there wasn't a heck of a lot of two-meter activity in Nigeria, never mind in Lagos. So I brought a two-meter rig. And the press reported back over 2 meters with an official license that I had, and that's how we got the signal back. Likewise, there was another incident in 1981 when Anwar Sadat was shot, and I got asked, would I go to Cairo? But there was going to be this one-mile walk where world leaders would walk along, and they wanted me to figure out a way to do some reporting. Well, how else? 2 meters. Back then, I used 2 meters in Cairo. We got the okay from the government. And these are the kinds of things that many, many hams in broadcasting have come up with. Years and years and years ago, we invented something called an auto patch that connected a telephone line to a transmitter. Well, they became telephone hybrids that you're using right now to record this call, and every radio station uses. And in television, we stack hybrids up 8 at a time, and we make our own conference bridges. All of these things come from the mind of a ham radio operator who says, you know, this is good, but I really think if we added this, that, and the other thing, we could make it better. And this is systems engineering, putting boxes together, putting concepts together to make something better. I've been very fortunate here at ABC that my first 9 years, they allowed me to be on the truck design team for Monday Night Football. So 2 generations of trucks, I was one of the three people that did the design of those trucks. Those are rolling control rooms, and to give you a rule of thumb, the average control room here at ABC has between 3 and 6 cameras. The average production truck that does football has between 19 and 28.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
How do you keep track? Do they actually bring all 19 online at times?
Sunday night football, Monday night football, 28 cameras every week.
Goodness.
Every week. But all of that pales in comparison to things that that I do on the side. As I said, I've been very, very lucky in that I'm also the communications director of the New York City Marathon, which comes up this Sunday, November 1st, in which I have 400 very talented ham radio operators, 406 right now, 406 of them, who are coming to New York from 9 different states to provide communications for the single largest marathon in the world. There are 45,000 people running. There are 10,000 volunteers on the course at the start and at the finish. There are over 3,000 people from the city of New York, police, fire, EMTs, ambulance people. And there are about 2 million people on the course. And the fabric, the mesh that keeps it all together and keeps it safe is ham radio. 11 simultaneous nets, net controls running on 450, on 2 meters, links from start to finish on 6 meters. APRS is used when somebody drops out on the course. We use data transmission to log who it is that's dropped out by bib number and where they're going. We have a set of codes to back to a hotel. That information is transmitted to the finish, to what's called the family reunion area, so that if their families are waiting at the finish and they're not going to the finish, we can tell the families where they are going. And an incredibly complex joint operations center where communications from every single New York City entity, as well as the FBI that's also involved, we have a comm center that's like very few others you'll ever see. All of this goes together for one day, and on the Monday it's done. But it's one of the things I'm most proud of is this incredible New York City marathon that the ham radio community is so, so deeply involved in.
Well, for those fellas that are listening that do, you know, things on a much smaller scale, you know, with bike-a-thons and other things, and there's a lot of that goes on.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the, some of them are not necessarily bike-a-thons. Some are just big, massive bike rides they use for whatever purpose, for charity or whatever. Why don't you tell a little bit about how this is set up? In other words, the mechanics of it, you know, a little bit, and give these folks a little bit of an idea as to maybe they'll pick up some ideas as to how to, better organize their events.
Well, that's about a 3-day conversation all in itself. It's actually organized. Communications always follows command. It's an old Navy term. And basically, I sit down as the communications coordinator. I listen to what the president, the executive vice president, the VP for operations, director for operations, they all say what it is that they want to do. And then I figure out functionally how to provide communications for whichever element they're talking about. Are we talking about runners dropping out on the course? Are we talking about medical communications on the course? If we're going to be dealing in sponsor issues, obviously ham radio can't handle that. So I look at it from a prohibited practices point of view also. Now, the communications director's job is radio. It's not ham radio. It's all kinds of radio. And if there are places where we need communications and ham radio can't handle it for legal purposes, then I recommend that they put parts of a trunked radio system in there. And what that means is we as hams are not hired for our hardware. We're hired for our communications talent. So if the communication is by trunked radio, by cell phone, by Nextel, or by ham radio, it doesn't matter. It's our ability as communicators that the community wants, not necessarily the piece of hardware. And I remind all of my people that there are many things that they could do that they can't do because of prohibited practices, 97.113, but they can do it on the commercial radio, so we try and make commercial radio available to them. Likewise, I have an incredibly gifted group of repeater owners who are kind enough to let me use their phenomenal facilities. They link the facilities where we need them, or if they're linked together, they break them apart so we can use them on various parts of the course. Now, a marathon is not a term of a race. It's a distance. It's 26 miles, 385 yards. Our job is to communicate down that course and to make sure that our communications are full quieting everywhere. So we've divided the course in half. We have a south course logistics, a north course logistics, course-wide medical, and all kinds of stuff like that that really makes it work for us.
Go ahead.
Now, the other thing I want to say is that I've been doing this for 33 years, and over those years, I've actually written a little book on how a lot of the decisions are made. It's not a book. It's about 26 pages. But anybody that wants one, W2ML at ARRL.org, W2MarathonLeader at ARRL.org, and I'll be glad to send them a copy of it. I'll email them a copy.
Well, that sounds really cool. I'd like to look that over myself. I'm kind of anxious to see this. Now, when you're using different bands and different frequencies, obviously.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so now, how do you, I mean, you mentioned even 6 meters, so I'm curious, how do you assign, I guess I want to say, a certain, you know, like, for example, the 2 meter band, how is it different, how is it used differently than, say, 440 or 6 meters?
We have 26 individual mile points that we have to cover. What I tell the mile captains, and there is a captain at every marathon mile, a ham radio captain, that captain has anywhere from 4 to 12 people working with him. And what I tell them is, one person goes to the medical station, there is one per mile, and the other 3 are asked to patrol a length of the course looking for runners that fall. If they fall, they can't get up, they want to drop out, having the hams there to help them is something that you can uniquely do on a 2-meter simplex. You don't have to use a 440 repeater. That uniquely works on a 2-meter simplex. Likewise, APRS is really a 2-meter tracking system. Most of the hardware, most of the software works best on 2. So APRS winds up being on 2 meters. The command and control net for all the very senior officials is one course-wide 440 repeater. The logistics repeaters sometimes are 2 meters, depends on the year, sometimes are 450. The distance from Staten Island to our finish line in Manhattan makes it unique that we have absolute communications, and that's where 6 meters comes in, because there are 6-meter repeaters in a number of very, very high places that make communications absolutely possible. Possible to a point where, because of the topography of the start line at the Verrazano Narrows toll plaza, you can't use cell phones there. So we use 6 meters, works perfectly.
Now, when you say that the cell phones don't work, what is the technical reason as to why they don't function?
The technical reason is that there's this large iron device called the Faraday Shield by me. Other people like to call it the Verrazano Narrows Bridge that shields most of the cell sites from the toll plaza. It's one of those crazy places on Earth where radio doesn't work except on 6 meters, and the cell phones don't work at all. The Nextels don't work at all. 800-900 meg equipment normally uses cells on the other side of the bridge or to the west, but to the west is also I won't call it a range of hills that shield the cell sites from this toll plaza. So it's one of these absolutely bizarre places where 6 meters works and nothing else does.
I'm just out of curiosity, for example, wouldn't you also have that kind of a problem in any of the tunnels?
Well, we don't go through tunnels. Yes, you definitely have that kind of problem in a tunnel, unless you're using leaky coax, technical term there. Leaky coax is designed by the cell industry to allow cell signals to at least go into the coax, and they have cell sites in most of the tunnels in New York City. I don't know about other areas, but they do in New York City. On the other hand, you can't use ham radio in a tunnel, although we have a very small convoy of 215 passenger vans that goes out to the starting line, and we do go through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel at about 3:30 in the morning. We got about 11 hams aboard among the other people. And we have had occasions where the hams have utilized the fact that you can't be heard outside the tunnel to discuss things or say things just for our own amusement, none of which you would ever want to say where others could hear you.
And I know asking about the tunnels is getting off track, but it's something that had went through my mind. I was visiting in New York City back a few years ago, and it was on July the 4th, and we got stuck on a bridge during the fireworks festivities. I mean, it just everything came to a screeching halt. Everybody just stopped driving. Or at least that's what it seemed like. And unfortunately, where we were, we couldn't see the fireworks. We could hear them, but we couldn't see them. But there must have been
a
lot of folks must have been stopped watching those fireworks on the bridge. And that was kind of a unique experience. I will say that. Now, you know, you're dealing with a marathon like that. Of course, you've got all the congestion from the city and all the normal traffic and everything going on around you. When you say you're using APRS, how do you incorporate APRS into this? Now, I understand you're using it, but, you know, in my little mind, I can't fathom how you're doing it.
We have a trail vehicle. We have a ham radio. Well, how do you use APRS? APRS is basically used in a trail vehicle to tell where the last vehicle in the race is. It's used on our sweep buses. It's used with our precursor vehicles that go down the course and distribute last-minute items to the hams and last-minute items to the various water stations. And we have a convoy of vehicles in front of the lead men and in front of the lead women, which go down the course at different times, and this allows the people back at the finish line to know where each of the moving elements of the race is. Additionally, each one of the police departments in each borough command has a ham radio operator in their temporary headquarters vehicle, and by knowing where the race is, the police department is then able to close the streets ahead of these convoys and ultimately ahead of this mass of runners.
Well, that's interesting because I've been fascinated with the use of this service, and I've got friends that are heavy into it, and it's always amazed me how simple it seems to work. You can just log into a website and you can find exactly where their vehicle is. I mean, right down to the last nut and bolt, and I guess that's a piece of technology. Are we responsible? Are amateur radio operators responsible for inventing that?
You'd have to ask Bob Runninger, WB4. I don't remember Bob's call. Yes, Bob was one of the early adopters. A number of people invented it, and APRS has been picked up by a huge number of commercial entities, and this is how buses get tracked, and this is how trains get tracked. APRS is very much a commercial entity right now, and it was invented by ham radio operators.
Well, I wondered about that, because I wondered about its... I know there's a lot of folks using GPS for all kinds of different things, but I wondered about our role in ARPS, and that is let me ask this. Why don't you do this? Because you understand it a lot better than I do. Describe the difference between someone using a GPS unit and someone using ARPS.
Okay. Amateur Packet Reporting System, APRS.
APRS, I'm sorry.
Is a device that transmits the location of the moving vehicle onto a packet network, viewable by anybody that has the technology. GPS is what each individual car uses to find out where they are. That's the difference. One is a receive mode, the other is a transmit mode.
The transmit mode, of course, coordinates through receivers that are connected to repeaters and
exactly. line.
And it talks this way.
The term you might be more familiar with is, it is the amateur equivalent of cell sites.
Okay, well, what I was wondering, because I know that there, I've had some fuzz in my head, because I can't even get the, you know, I want to call it ARPS instead of APRS, or I can't get the acronym correct. So I'm sure that this exists in the minds of those that are wondering about it. They're thinking, well, what's the difference between that and a GPS? You know, is one more accurate than the other? But that would be absolutely, totally invaluable to in a situation like that, because with the amount of activity that you're dealing with, and sometimes maybe a severe situation, this is like an instant fix on wherever that person is, and that's just invaluable.
The number of times that in various events you hear people say, "Trail vehicle, where are you?" If they have to say that 120 to 150 times, you've just eliminated 150 transmissions simply by putting APRS on a vehicle. Now, what APRS can't do is answer questions. If the vehicle sits in one position because they got a flat tire, all the APRS equipment in the world can't pick up the mic and say, "We got a flat tire, it's going to be a while." There are some people that insisted at one year that I just use APRS and not use voice. And I asked a simple question, what happens if we have to ask a question? So the answer is, it's wonderful as a device to do a certain job. It is a tool. It's not the answer to everything.
Well, I know in town, this is kind of a funny story. That's a friend of mine that's running APRS, and when he would get to a certain point in town, the system, the repeaters and part of the network or whatever, left off there. There was no coverage in that area.
Sure.
So it appeared on the map that he had stopped at a particular location, you know, until the system picked him back up again somewhere else.
And then it would appear he moved.
Yeah. But then what was funny is where the location where it appeared that he disappeared, he got accused of being somewhere where he had never stopped, which was kind of... So there, it got, that was one case.
You seem to find that unusual or certainly funny, but anybody that knows the technology knows that that's also one of the Achilles' heels of the technology. It isn't perfect. It's a little bit like, I guess the analogy that I keep thinking of is the people that have cell phones that get very frustrated when the cell phone service drops out, because we are so used to a quality of service as a society. We're so used to a quality of service in our wired phones that we expect the same thing from essentially our handheld transceivers. And when the transceivers drop out because there's a metal object in the way or some other thing that causes the laws of physics to come into play, we get terribly frustrated because we expect to have the same quality as our landline service, and that just doesn't happen, nor does it happen with APRS. The signal can remain static. One of the problems we had is that on one of the bridges, because of the meshwork on the bridge, APRS, if you watch the signal, it looks like he's staying at one end of the bridge and suddenly hops over it, because the mesh keeps the signal from being radiated while he's on the bridge. The cables, the roadway mesh, all of that keeps him from being spotted. So it's very funny to watch, because they'll say so-and-so's coming to the 59th Street Bridge. Oh, he just jumped over.
Well, now your marathon, tell me a little bit about the beginnings of this. I know you've been involved in it for a long time.
Well, yeah. The rumor that I've been involved in the original marathon, which was the one where a runner ran in Greece to announce that Athens had been defeated, I think that was it. That happened about 2500 B.C. The rumor that I was involved in that is not true. However, when the modern marathon picked up in 1976, a crazy man named Fred Lebow had the idea that running could be the next great spectator sport. And so he started this concept of taking a race that had been run in Central Park. They ran 4 6-mile laps in Central Park and then a little bit. And He took it out to the five boroughs. He said that the city of New York should embrace this, that running was something that would keep people fit. And between 1976 and 1994, when he passed on, Fred literally single-handedly built the running craze. There had been a marathon, oddly enough, that had run for many years before that in Boston. But marathons started in Chicago, in Miami, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, all because people saw that, hey, this running thing, it's pretty easy. As a matter of fact, most people train for it by walking from the time they're a small child. And so the running craze began. The city of New York, hoping to stop Fred in his tracks, came up with this absolutely cruel idea that the only way it could be done would be if the marathon committee had communications from one end of the course to the other. This, they figured, would be the technological stopper that would end this crazy man's dream. Well, one of the board members at the time was a man named Len Dewey, K2KRI. Len knew that the group that could do this were the repeater owners in the New York, New Jersey area. And so he came to a meeting of the Tri-State Amateur Repeater Council, and he asked for volunteers to help provide communications. I was the vice president at that time. That was 1975. And somehow I got hooked up with being the guy that was going to put the thing together. I enjoyed it very, very much. I enjoyed working with Fred. It was very different than anything else in my life. And now here we are. Sunday will be the 33rd year, exactly half my life, that I've been doing this. And the energy in this city is just incredible on Marathon Day. It is the New York we all wish we could have 365 days a year. You see people working together that on any other day probably would be playing cops and robbers. You see communities come out and give of themselves in ways that are just unbelievable. And at the end of the day, there are tens of thousands of stories of how somebody in New York helped somebody from out of the country or out of the city in some way, just to show their humanity, that will make a change in people's attitudes towards New York City for the rest of their life. This is the city everybody dreams could exist, and it happens on Marathon Day.
We'll be right back with our special guest, Steve Mendelson, W2ML, right after this.
Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews, or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast, but be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL. And we'll look for your email. And now, ladies and gentlemen, on QSO, back to our guest, Steve Mendelson, W2ML. You know, it's special events like this, I think, that
that kind of cement the ties between people in a community, and even as large as it is, New York City is a community. I mean, well, all the boroughs, everything included. And, you know, I've found folks that are natives of the area, or folks that have moved into the area and have lived there for any period of time, they develop a totally different kind of pride about where they live that I don't see in any other part of the country. I mean, you talk to people from Chicago that are proud of Chicago and they live in Chicago. But there's nothing like a New Yorker. You get a hold of somebody that is from the Big Apple and they've lived there for any length of time, and there is a completely different, unique sort of pride and image that they project about where they live. Now, do you find that to be the case, or is that just me?
Well, that's a little bit like asking a New Yorker if he likes where he lives. And the answer is, yeah. Yes. New Yorkers are very, very proud of being in one of the great cities in the world. New Yorkers, there's a saying, of course, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. That's because the pace of this city is incredibly fast. But it isn't really a city. It's a whole bunch of little communities. It's a bunch of tiny little enclaves, all five boroughs, each one having its own its own history, its own group of people, its own identity, different from the rest of the city. The New York City Marathon is a trip through history. As you drive down the streets and you go through the large Italian section, the large Hispanic areas, the large African-American areas, the large Russian and Eastern European areas, every single area has a vibrant community that is part of what makes America great. This is the great melting pot. This is where people came from when they first got off the boat 100 years ago, and now when they get off the airplanes, and they stay here, and they put their brand on America, whether it's the Italians, whether it's the Eastern Europeans, whether it's the English, whether it's the Russian communities we have here now. And you see this all. It's the reason that I do this. I've done it for 33 years because that 2 hours riding down the course is the most fantastic 2 hours that any human being can experience. And to see this wonderful race close up, I'm never more than a block away, it's worth everything in the world to me, and the city, and the people in the city, and the smiles, and the cheers for runners, for people they don't even know. When you hit First Avenue at mile 16, the energy is just unbelievable. People talk about how the crowds, 10 deep, going up First Avenue, hanging out of windows, hanging off the apartment buildings, and not just for the lead runners, but for hours and hours and hours, cheering on the guy who came in from Willamette, Arkansas, cheering the guy who came in from Salem, Oregon, not just the lead runners, not just the big guys, but the middle of the pack and the rear of the pack runners. When you feel that, you don't see it, you don't smell it, you feel it. And when you feel it, it energizes you and gives you reason. It's the feedback for all the public service we do.
Well, you know, I guess I want to say that is, it sounds to me like this is one of the most unique events that's taking place anywhere in the United States. But you
anywhere
have,
in the world, Ed. This is the largest marathon in the world.
Well, but you have people coming from, I mean, they come specifically to run in this thing. But they come from great distances. Now, what do you think draws them in? Is it that energy? Is there anything else that you can think of that would cause a person to come from Oregon to run in this marathon?
Well, I guess the best analogy I can give is, why would a man sit on a 8x8 platform on top of a rock in the middle of the Pacific Ocean talking on a radio? Why would a man want to operate from the top of Mount McKinley with a 1-watt radio on HF? Human beings challenge themselves. As ham radio operators, We go to far off places, most of which are uninhabited. We call them a country. And the pileup is unbelievable. It drives you when you have this huge pileup. I've operated from Malta as 9H3LO, Liberia as EL2 Sugar Mike, from Scotland as GM5 Able Hotel Spain when I was in the Navy, and on and on and on. And when you're at the bottom of the pileup and they're calling you hot and fast and you're working, it's a high the likes of which can only be reflected in the number of runners who say that when you run every day, the adrenaline you get from the New York City Marathon is like a high that no drug ever will be able to give you. So the answer is, why did they come? It's the energy of New York. It's the companionship of a long-distance run where you're going to meet people who you'll never see again, or perhaps they will quickly become your best friend. But whatever it is, it's drawn 45,000 people this year. There were 108,000 applicants because they want to see those 2 million people out on the course. And what holds it all together are 400-plus ham radio operators.
Well, you know, one of the things I was going to ask you about, and that is this. Press-wise, you have all those hams that are there providing the communications.
Right.
And I know that as a group, the radio amateurs are not wanting to steal the thunder from the runners, or there isn't any competitiveness there, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right.
But by the same token, they're as much a part of it as the runner is. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
You know, and but I'm curious, how do you are you able to use that as far as the general public is concerned to bring about an awareness as to what you guys are doing and how this is all working together?
Did you read Newsday yesterday?
No, I did not.
Did you read the Washington Post yesterday?
No, I don't get those papers. So,
did you read the Chicago Sun-Times?
No, I did not.
You see, if I'd put articles about ham radio in all of them, you wouldn't know that they existed. And that's exactly my point. There are newspapers that do sidebars on amateur radio. I'm also the game day frequency coordinator for the New York Jets. We use an enormous amount of radio in football. You never once hear about the guy who's involved with all the radio equipment. All you hear about is the football game. The event, from a news perspective, is about running. It's about the people that win. The sidebars are usually about not the support staff, but about those human interest stories that are going to appeal to the wide audience. But if you had read Runner Magazine 2 years ago, the results, the New York City Marathon results issue, you would have seen a very nice piece about amateur radio. And if you had read QST in 95 and 2003, you would have seen articles on ham radio. In order to talk to the public, the one thing I don't want to do is have a ham radio article in a ham radio magazine. The public doesn't read ham radio magazines. I make sure that there's a little insert in the press kit about what amateur radio does, and we always have one or two papers from around the country that do a quick interview with me. But in this world, one of the principles of advertising is you have to tell the story over and over and over again. If you tell it once, it goes in and out of the ears with equal speed. And ham radio at the marathon, remember I said 10,000 volunteers, we're 400 of 10,000. Are we any more important than the marshals out on the course that make sure everybody's safe? Are we more important than the doctors at each mile point that if a person falls down, they take care of them? To the person that fell down, that doctor is the most important person. To the marathon committee, we are very important. But we are one of 10,000 volunteers and essentially 135, 136 volunteer groups.
Well, the only reason I ask is because at times I feel like, especially dealing with shortwave, I get a taste of it as well. And that is, it seems like years ago the public awareness of amateur radio was, I guess I want to say, it was much higher than it is now. And I'm always anxious, you know, for any opportunity at all, for us to not necessarily get recognized, but at least identified, if that makes any sense at all.
Well, one of the problems you have in all of this is that when ham radio was king back in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, we were the only communications technology around. Now, it isn't that we're less important. It's that the perception of the public is that technology is ho-hum. go explain to the kid who's working on Xbox. And by the way, the society we live in is more technologically in tune. They know what the internet is, what Skype is. They know what the wired world is and the wireless world. They're far more technologically advanced than they were 40 years ago. And remember that technology advances logarithmically, not linearly. And because of that, they take communications for granted. If the internet ever goes down and people are forced to go back to reading books, they will not know how to do it. The children of today know what the internet is. They all have Facebook, they all have Skype, they all have Twitter. Take the internet away, and I don't think they're going to know what to do with themselves. The general public knows technology a lot better than it did when ham radio was king. Now we're just another hobby. And I'll bet you don't know as much about how they make ring toss as you do about how you make transmitters. And yet to the ring toss community, that's very important.
Well, let me ask you this in closing, because I know you've got to go. With that in mind, and working for ABC and the position that you're in and the things that you have to do and the responsibilities and all the things, how vulnerable at this point do you think we are as a society? How reliable do you think all these communication satellites are and all this? I mean, it seems to me it's a pretty delicate balance, and it wouldn't take a whole lot to plunge us into darkness. I mean, and I'm just wondering about that. Do you ever think about that in your job as to how dependent you are on all these different things?
Oh, absolutely. And then I walk around to the back of the car, and I look down at the bumper, and on the bumper is a little sticker that says, "When all else fails, amateur radio." The answer is, I don't think the world understands today. I don't think today's children or young adults understand how important technology is to them. If everything went away, if electricity went away, we don't need the internet to go away. Just have a power failure in a town, a city, or on the East Coast. And watch how quickly we revert to small villages. People walking around with flashlights until the batteries go bad. A few of us who have been through these things have generators that we crank over once or twice a year, so we'll have some power. But we are totally dependent on electricity. If electricity goes away, this entire society would have to find other ways of communicating, going way, way back, going back 120, 130 years. And I think to a very great extent it would stop humanity cold if they lost their internet, lost their telephones, lost their television, their radio. So whenever I get to that point, I walk around to the back of the car and remember that when all else fails, amateur radio will be there.
You know, we hear a lot about EMP, electromagnetic pulse or whatever.
Yep.
If something like that were to happen, how would that affect the major television networks and whatnot? Would it affect them?
Well,
or?
Let me tell you an apocryphal story. In 1989, the U.S. Navy took a destroyer loaded with solid-state gear out to sea, and they blew off a small EMP blast to see what would happen. Most of the electronics were destroyed. However, a couple of the chiefs who were ham radio operators had gone out and got some old World War II receivers and put them on board. And guess what survived?
So your Collins KWM-2, the Drake TR-4, and the Swan 350s will live
long after you and I are gone, yes. And someday I know that my KWM-2 will be in a museum somewhere, and people will say, "Wow, they use stuff that big to communicate," while they flick open their belt, take out a little tiny communicator, and talk to somebody.
Well, sir, I really appreciate your time. I know you've got to go. We could talk for the rest of the day, and I wouldn't get bored. I don't know about you, but listening to...
I enjoy this very much. It's very rare in my world that I do get a chance to express views like this because, for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the group that does this all the time is the ARRL board. Some of the greatest minds in America are on that board. And amateur radio as a group, whether you love or hate the league and its policies, unless you've been inside when those discussions are taking place, you cannot appreciate the length and breadth of what we have as a national organization. And next to that, this has been the most fun I've had in years.
Well, I really appreciate your time. And I thank you very much, and you'll have to come back because there's a lot of other things I'd like to talk to you about at some point.
So, you got the number. It's up to you.
All right. Well, you have a good day,
sir. If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com. If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Innerbitzen, NQ1R. He's the marketing manager for the American Radio Relay League. Our guest is Bob Innerbitzen, NQ1R. That's the call sign. I told him that was a good DX call sign. He's the marketing manager for the American Radio Relay League, the National Association of Amateur Radio. And welcome in, Bob. How are things going in Newington today?
Well, great. It's great to talk to you, Ted, and appreciate being on the air today. Things are going well in Newington. We're busy. And as those of us in New England march towards the winter months, we also know this is a busy time for amateur radio. Lots of contests going on and plenty to keep us busy here at headquarters.
Of course, you know, we're getting into the Thanksgiving season, and of course, as soon as you get into this time of the year, folks are thinking about Christmas.
That's right.
And they're just
like that.
They're visualizing that new rig under the Christmas tree.
I'm convinced that more hams open up their wallets and buy for themselves this time of year.
Well, yeah, you buy the rig and
someone else wraps it up for you.
Yeah. But anyhow, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about today, and that is, we keep seeing the emails here and there on the different publications and things that the league is offering. Sometimes they're running sales and some sort of savings on certain books and whatnot. What's hot right now? What books are going that you see a lot of? Let's talk about trends in books. What are guys buying right now?
Yeah, you bet. Well, Ted, this time of year, the ARRO Handbook comes out in a new edition each year in October. And this has been a particularly important year for the handbook because it represents a year where it's a significantly revised edition. In fact, nearly 70% of the book is new this year. there's probably 60 authors that go into producing a book like the Handbook. So on a year where there's a lot of new content, the amateur community really responds with great interest in that particular edition. So the Handbook is very popular. You know, these days the league produces a number of its own publications, and we carry a number of third-party books as well. Sort of that one-stop shopping for everything related to amateur radio. On our side of the equation, we've got a number of new titles that we've introduced over the last months. Probably one of the more popular ones is the second edition of VOIP by Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD, who I think you just did something with recently.
We had him on to talk about the birth and the operation of Echolink, and that was really cool.
That's right, and that VOIP book is a real winner for us. It's sort of the handbook to VOIP. So we also have a software compilation on CD-ROM that came out this year, sort of a one CD that has DXing bulletin software on there, weather satellite software, book excerpts, contesting software. It's a real popular one, too. We also carry a number of publications from the Radio Society of Great Britain. We have a great relationship with our sister societies around the world. And, of course, the Radio Society of Great Britain produces English written books. And so the ham radio marketplace in the U.S. is a great place for those as well. The IOTA directory came out this year from RSGB, and they've published a number of technical journals and books this year as well.
Well, you were talking about this. Is it a CD or a DVD that's got the programs on it?
A CD-ROM.
Okay. Now, the reason I was asking about that is because, to me, now that seems like that would really be handy, but yet I know a lot of guys would say, well, why would I want to buy that if I can download this stuff?
You know, I said the same thing because, of course, what do I do when I find myself preparing for November sweepstakes? The day of the contest, I find myself putting up my antenna, repairing the station, and hunting around for software to do my logging.
Well,
and this has been a nice way to vet some of the software that's out there and include some applications that are sort of tried and true.
Well, let me say this. Now this is nothing against us hams. But I don't know how many times I see a link to a piece of software and click on it and it's a dead link, you know, and because we're transient, we're not like businesses. We don't keep a website for 12 years. You know what I mean? So guys move things around and links change and they move their website somewhere else. So sometimes it's not real easy to locate that one program you're looking for, because I just went through that a little while ago. I was looking for something.
Very good point, Ted. You're absolutely right. And the league is very much a publishing house for the radio amateur community also. So we let the radio amateur community produce good stuff, and then we provide them with some infrastructure to get their word out there, whether that's books, articles, software, whatever is related to the amateur radio community. We want to be sort of that one-stop place where you can find it.
Well, that's cool. Now, just out of curiosity, what does that CD sell for?
Sure, that one's $19.95, and it's version 3.0. and it's available both from ARRL and our publication dealers around the country and around the world.
I just, you know, to me, I think it's handy, to have the thing and know all those programs that I may want are on the CD, and I can access them at any point in time. And I'm sure you've got some remote control software on there, and I don't know what all else you'd have, but if it has to do with ham radio.
That's right, and these days with HF Digital being as popular as it is, each time the software comes out, there's usually a new protocol, some sort of digital protocol included on there. I know the current version has PSK31 and MFSK16 and MT63 and RIDI and the whole long list of digital software applications on there. But having that all at your fingertips, I think for some of us who have smaller amounts of time in the evening to spend on our avocation, it's nice to be able to install those software tools quickly and get up and on the air with our computer and our integrated stations.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. ham radio today, you know, there's so many different things going on, you know. So here, you know, I sit here sometimes and I think to myself, you know, I'd like to try this or I'd like to try that. And you almost if you're ADD like I am, you know, you can't really land on the thing you want to do. There's so many different things. It certainly is not like it was, you know, 30, 40 years ago, you know.
That's right. And, you know, that's part of the challenge, and the a good challenge that the ARRL has is, you know, 50, 60 years ago, our publication bookshelf was a lot smaller than it is today. But so were the niches in amateur radio. There weren't a whole lot of them. Today, there's just so many different directions to go. The course of technology has really marched on in many, many different directions. Some of our amateur community spend a lot of time in public service and emergency communications work. Portions of our membership are very much involved in very technical aspects of amateur radio. Sometimes there's crossover between some of that, and sometimes there isn't. So having publications, resources, software, content to kind of keep stirring all the pots in amateur radio is important. But it also means that our bookshelf is very big these days.
You know, I, of course, the handbook, the antenna handbook. I remember when the antenna handbook was a small book. It was you know, a little bit bigger than a paperback, you know, and then it grew, and now it's about the same size as the big handbook.
Yeah, I can't quite remember how many, but it's a big phone book size book these days. And of course, a lot of our flagship books, like the handbook and the antenna book, all include software with them, CD-ROMs that contain the entire content of the book on a CD-ROM. The nice thing about that is, of course, there's nothing beats flipping through the book. But when you want to find something quickly, having the CD allows you to do a quick text search. Get to that portion of the book. You can print the portion of the book. You can do you can find supplemental software on the CD. But the antenna book is quite a monster. I would say our flagship publications for the league these days include the handbook, the antenna book, and the ARRL operating manual.
You know, I guess I remember the operating manual being very small back a few years ago.
That's right.
It was almost like a pamphlet. You know, more than it was a book at that time.
This is another particular portion of our publication line that really reflects the diversity of the amateur radio community. We want to provide an operating manual that sort of gives the general ham an idea on all the things that they can possibly do, even though their interest may only be one particular area. You know, the only way we continue to promote lifelong learning in amateur radio is if we float different interest areas in front of folks. You might be interested in MCOM, but you know, we find that some people have found ways to weave their interest in digital communications with MCOM. So there's entire portions of the operating manual that cover a variety of different interests these days in amateur radio. Field days covered in the operating manual. There's lots of good reference tables and lists in that book that give you quick access to call sign prefixes or tables of just about anything you can imagine. Having that at your fingertips is great when you're at an event like Field Day or at a contest, or just keeping it next to your shack.
Well, you know, one thing that I've always thought was cool. I was always the ARRL has always had cool maps. I mean, you know,
that's right.
And you could always get these cool maps, and they were all mapped out with the, you know, either grid squares or sections and the world maps. And then they always had charts that you could get. And of course, when I was a kid, I loved to plaster those all over the walls.
You know? I think my first product that I'd ever purchased from the league, and it was my grandmother back in 1982, was an ARRL worked all states map she had bought me for Christmas. And boy, over the years, I had covered that thing with pins and writing, and it was a well-used and lived map. But the maps are still very popular. In fact, a lot of us pride ourselves in knowing the difference between a Robinson projection map or an azimuthal projection map. We have a lot of really nice projections for the different maps, and we've worked very closely with folks at colleges and universities to make sure that the map data on those are actually very, very accurate. And then, of course, with the DXCC experts here to make sure that the prefix data reflects the most current information that we can include on those maps.
Well, let's talk just a second here about the new updated handbook. What do you know any of the newer type of content that they put into this thing?
I do. You know, one of the most popular parts of the handbook each year is the new projects. And this particular year, there's a new 250-watt solid-state amplifier for 160 through 6 on, in there. Amplifier projects are always a mainstay in the handbook. There's a variable voltage bench supply using switch mode modules, a bunch of new antenna projects in the book, including an extended double ZEP, multi-band horizontal loop, some inexpensive Yagis for VHF, UHF, and, of course, accessories, because you can build an accessory over the weekend sometimes. But this edition's accessories include a high-power 160-80-meter matching network for 43-foot verticals and a 100-watt Z-match antenna tuner and transmitting chokes. It's just really chock full of a lot of really fantastic new projects. The digital content in the handbook has gotten an entire new facelift, and that's very popular too. Again, I think I mentioned some 60 authors worked with the handling editors of this book to pull this edition off. It's quite a masterpiece.
Now it's available like in a paperback and also a hardcover, is it not?
Well, at this point, we have sold out of the hardcover. There was a early bird promotion for the hardcover, but the soft cover continues to be available. It includes the CD-ROM, and the retail price on that book is $49.95. It's available also directly from the league or from publication dealers around the country.
Well, you know, that's a deal, because you can't go in a bookstore today and buy a computer reference book for under $60 hardly. I mean, they're really.
I know. You know, we often feel real proud that we can compare our books to a lot of the very technical publications that are out there in the professional arena. And like you said, we're found right on the shelf in a lot of RF engineering labs, radio stations, libraries around the country. We're real proud of that the book has such long legs.
We'll be right back with our guest, Bob Interbitson, NQ1R, the marketing manager for the ARRL, right after this. If you already own a TW2010 Adventurer or Backpacker antenna, and you want to use the antenna on 40 meters, you can get the Transworld Adventurer 4040 array box in center section only. Right now, only $139.95. That puts you on 40 meters, and you're dealing with the exact same antenna structure that has made the TW2010 Transworld Adventurer so famous. The black powder coating, the stealth, the way the antenna is able to hide. And in addition to that, it's portable if you want to take it with you. Of course, you can get it with a deluxe travel bag. It's just fantastic. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. If you can't remember Transworld Antennas, just remember to go to our website at QSO, tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, and click on the link for Transworld Antennas. Take a look at this brand new Adventurer 4040. Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello, tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air. But don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, "I want to win." And let's see who the lucky winners will be.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, on QSO, back to our guest, Bob Innerbitzen, NQ1R, the marketing manager for the ARRL.
Well, you know, I was saying, you know, going back in the broadcast engineering arena a number of years, every time you'd walk into a radio station, the station would subscribe, I think, actually, to the NAB Engineering Handbook, and they would send these little addendas, you know, these things you'd have to. Some of them were in binders. You could open them up and stick more material and more material in. But the fact of the matter is that the book was huge, you know, and it was a little difficult to navigate. And especially if you were finding something in there, it was usually way over the head of what you were trying to do. You know, it was just too much. Anyways, now you walk into a radio station almost anywhere in the country, and you will invariably find the ARRL handbook, you know, on the shelf, and multiple copies. I mean, going back a few years, you know. And one thing about it is, and of course you know this as well as I do, hams have the ability from a technical standpoint to kind of cut to the chase to get the job done. You know,
that's right, in true Yankee Doodle fashion.
And the handbook is really good about that, because you open up the handbook, and there's certain concepts over a period of time you'll forget. You know, you'll say, now, wait a minute. Let me think here. You know, and there's some concept that you're thinking of, but you can't remember. I don't know, maybe something involving impedance or standing wave or transmission lines or something, you know. And you go up the handbook, and even though they don't go into all the real detailed math, that concept is laid out there in enough detail. Oh, yeah, now I remember how that works, you know.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's important for the handbook to continue to represent that folks come into amateur radio with a variety of different background and skill, especially in fundamental theory and design. Some of us are quite novice at that, and some of us are much more advanced or extra in our understanding of some of that content. The book is very well organized to speak to that. I think one of the things that hasn't changed for a number of years about the book is that the first chapter is what is amateur radio, and from there we go very quickly into fundamental theory, electrical basics, electrical fundamentals, analog and digital basics, and then we start working our way through RF design. We've also come out with a lot of supplemental books to help people along. We have a series of basic books as sort of primers for folks who want a little bit more of the background in basic math and engineering theory for RF. Books like ARRL's Understanding Basic Electronics, ARRL's Understanding Basic Radio, and Basic Antennas. It's a nice series of books that really bridge the gap between, say, the license manuals and a book like the ARRL Handbook.
Well, you know, a specialized book, especially given to a young person at the right age. Now, the overall ARRL handbook may be a bit overwhelming, you know, if to give to somebody that's just, you know, a kid wanting to
sure.
get into ham radio. But now some of the study guides. I remember when I was very, very young, I had a cousin on my mom's side of the family gave me a book. I'll never forget it. It was called How to Read Schematic Diagrams by Donald Harrington.
Okay.
Have you ever seen the book?
No, I haven't seen that one. But
it's ages old.
I've heard of something like that. That's great.
You know, and you know what? I studied that and read it over and over and over again, because it was not a real big book. You know, it was a little thin book, and I read it over, and it just drilled into me every symbol there was, and that changed my whole life because I was, I mean, I could pick up a schematic and read it and just, you know, boom, I knew exactly what was going on.
Yeah, you know, the ARRL's Understanding Basic Electronics book is very much a basic electronics book that doesn't necessarily require you to know anything about amateur radio to learn about basic electronics. And the book is actually used by a number of middle schools around the country in their electronics shop classes because it's just such a very well-written book as a basic electronics primer. We see this quite a bit with different ARRL titles. In fact, you know, license manuals used to teach kids English as a second language in schools and different ways that young people use some of the ARRL publications.
Just out of curiosity, now, let me make sure I got this right. The new handbook is what? Did you say $49.95?
It's $49.95. That's right. And it's available directly from the league at www.arrl.org/shop. If you put the /shop, you'll go right into the ARRL's online store. And there's also a hot link there where you can locate dealers. In case you're interested in finding an ARRL publication dealer in your community or online that that maybe you shop from already and you want to give them the business, we're happy to see that you do that.
Now, what does the antenna handbook go for?
The antenna handbook, I believe, is $44.95.
So just a little bit less. Now does that include? Does that also come with a CD?
It sure does. Yes. In fact, they look like kissing cousins when they're side to side. The antenna book, just pulling it up in the online store real quick, is in fact $44.95. But I understand that there's a special offer for ordering it before December 31st. You save $5. So right now it's on sale for $39.95.
Oh, very good. You know, see, the problem is if you want to order something like that for Christmas, you've got to find a good place to hide it. If you're like I am, you've got a house.
That's a nice suite of gift, a set of books like the ARRL antenna book, the handbook, and the operating manual would probably bring a smile to almost any ham's face.
Well, yeah, and it's very reasonable. In other words, it's of course, you see, you know, I live in a house full of hams. So it's hide. You can't hide anything in here. I mean, you know.
That's right. I think when I went to college, I attended school up at Worcester Polytechnic Institute for a few years back in my early days. I remember the first rule of getting a book while we were in college there, especially a ham radio book, was to take out that Sharpie and write your call sign on the spine.
Oh yeah, that was, or somebody's gonna borrow that and forget that it belonged
to
you.
Right.
Let's talk a bit. I mean, the books and publications. You know, one more thing. There is a whole series of antenna books though that you folks put out. I mean, there's one like on verticals and one on long wires. I mean, there's, if you have some niche interest in antennas. How many of those are there? How many different books?
That's right. Yeah, we probably have about 20 or so different titles that are the league's own antenna publications. But we also carry another easily 20 books that are produced by all sorts of organizations and individuals, including the Radio Society of Great Britain and other publishers around the country. You're right. You know, the antennas are one of those things where we can still make a big we can still have a hand at that construction in our own shacks. It's if you have some wire and a design, you can test out all different types of antennas. And again, in sort of that Yankee Doodle fashion, the league has piles and piles of different antenna design compilations. One of our popular series is the ARRL Antenna Compendium series, and I think we have volumes 1 through 7. There's no overlap between the books, and you can dive in at any one of those volumes. But there's everything from VHF to HF to low band antennas in there, beverages, all sorts of good stuff.
I guess I want to say the antennas are projects, you know, that people enjoy delving into. I mean, there's nothing more fun than building an experimental antenna and getting on the air and testing it out, you know, and then maybe comparing it. A lot of folks don't have the room to do this, you know. Of course, there's a lot of low-profile antennas that work surprisingly well, that you can experiment and build with. But the other thing is projects. Now, you know, I have had several people tell me, they say, well, you know, the day of the project builder is over, you know, but when I went to Dayton, I noticed all the kit companies, you know, and of course we lost the Heath Kit Company years ago, but they were more big projects. I mean, they have actual transceivers and stuff.
Sure,
and of course,
sure.
Today we have some folks out there like Elecraft, but what about the books that talk about the QRP projects and things that are just really, really cool to build that you can do in several days and get on the air with? Now,
yeah. One of my favorite authors in the QRP arena is Rich Arlen, K7 Sugar Zulu, and Rich is well known in the QRP community, and he's published a number of editions of a book called ARRL's Low Power Communication: The Art and Science of QRP, and it's a great little book. It's by no means an overwhelming publication. He has a great sense of excitement in exploring low power radio in the early chapters of the book, and then he really digs in, talking about some of the kit building and homebrew opportunities in QRP radio. Well, when we came out with the latest edition of that in late 2007, we decided to reach out to a couple different kit manufacturers and ultimately decided to bundle the book itself with the MFJ CW Cub transceiver kit. It's a 40-meter kit, and boy, I'll tell you, the number of people who just got very excited about both learning from Rich Arland about QRP and the culture of low power operating, but also built that CW Cub transceiver kit was incredible. I think even the folks at MFJ were very pleased with how nice that bundling went. And in fact, there's been a number of instances where folks who have built that Cub transceiver kit have all gotten together on the air over a certain weekend here or there and tested out their radios together.
Well, that's amazing, but having the guidance, you know, the books there that have the diagrams in them, and some of the fellows that write these books actually provide a printed circuit board, you know, that you can email them or order through them, or they have the board made up somewhere. And,
that's right, yeah. And some of the books include the PC board templates or include CD-ROMs out of the PC board templates. And then, again, there's a pile of different QRP kit manufacturers out there now that make kit building something that you can do sometimes in just a few hours. As part of the promotion to learn about this new MFJ Cub kit that we were carrying, we pushed a bunch of staff here at Aero headquarters through our laboratory to have them build the 40-meter kit themselves. And it was about a two-day project for most of us. For some of the staff here, it was their first time ever soldering. And for a lot of us, it was sort of a chance to revisit something that we enjoyed doing when we first got our ham radio licenses decades ago, but found that there was still great fun in building your own equipment. And that was great fun, and the MFJ equipment was really easy to work with in order to pull that off. Probably the icing on the cake was taking those kits into the ARL screen room to test them out.
And how did that go?
It was fun. It was you know, the Technical Information Service engineers at the league actually put the equipment up on the spectrum analyzer and got their and really fine-tuned our equipment and showed us what we did right and what we could have maybe done better with some of our solder joints. And it was really great fun. But looking at that little tiny Cub transceiver kit inside the big Aerial screen room was really a neat experience.
You know, there's nothing more fun though than starting off with a handful of parts, you know, and
and
I remember when you know, in the manuals, of course, when you were building Heath kits, it would say, you know, join this wire and this wire, and then would say do not solder, you know, and that was because you had to add more stuff later, you know.
That's right. And Ted, what did they tell us to do first, though? They told us to take an inventory of all of our parts and check them off against the list. And I can't tell you how many times I got too excited and dove right in and then wondered where that resistor or capacitor was located or if it was ever shipped with the thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And one of the things that a kit builder showed me a long time ago is he would take a cardboard box and he would cut it open, a good size one. I mean, like you have, so you could work with it on the table. So you'd cut it open, you'd leave the bottom of the box intact, but then the sides of the box you would slope with a razor blade, and the back you would leave just the way it is. And then the little, you know, the little perforations in the cardboard, you know, where it kind of,
yeah.
You know, he'd stick all the resistors in one, you know, all the caps, everything, in all these little holes all the way around.
Isn't that neat?
So you could, I mean, it was real easy visually to locate the parts. And I'll never forget that, because the first time I ever saw that done, I thought, wow, you know. So
yeah, absolutely. But it helps you really, you set up that way, and then the rest of the project comes together a lot easier.
Yeah, I was kind of blessed, because I had a bunch of older fellows that asked me to build things for them. They'd order the Heath kit. They'd give it to me to build, and then and of course they would operate it. Of course, I'm sure they told their friends they had built their transceiver, or they built, you know. I don't know how many SB200s I put together, a bunch of them.
Oh, that's funny. You know, my first radio was an SB102, and my father had taken me to a TV repair shop where we saw this thing in the window for a number of weeks, and it was already assembled. And I wanted to get my hands on this radio. I was a novice licensee, and I really wanted to get on the air. So my dad bought it for me, but it didn't have a manual, and I couldn't figure out quite how to tune it. And I remember writing a postcard to the league. I was about 12 or 13 years old. And about a week and a half later, in the mail was an envelope with 150 pages of photocopied or photostat paper that had the entire manual in it. And a little note that said, compliments of the league, and if your parents should have an opportunity to send us a couple dollars to cover the photocopy, we'd appreciate it.
That was very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, it was one of my first experiences with the ARRL, and one that's stuck with me ever since, especially when I think about my contact with ARRL members and prospective members.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, when I was talking about the building the SB200s, The linear amplifiers are relatively easy to put together because the parts are big, you know, and there's a lot of room to work. But I'll tell you, some of the transceivers were pretty challenging. I thought they were.
I can imagine.
Because, you know, everything was small, and it was a lot smaller, and there was, you know, and I'm ADD, so, I mean, you put a bajillion number of parts in front of me, and I'm like, you know, I'm totally overwhelmed. You just talked about something about the league, and I want to cover this real quick, and I don't want to keep you too long. About benefits of league membership. What does it cost right now for a person to be a member of the ARRL?
Sure. Well, membership is $39 a year, and that's for domestic membership in the United States. Membership includes monthly delivery of QST Magazine, our flagship publication that we've been publishing since 1915. And so you get one of those every month in the mailbox.
Let me ask a question. Can you even subscribe to a major magazine of any kind? I mean, can you subscribe to Newsweek for $39 a year? I don't know. I mean,
that's part of the challenge, and one of the reasons why I'm here is to work with the organization to find ways to extend the benefits beyond what the typical dues amount can really afford. ARRL publication sales, the advertising that we have in some of our publications, the shirts and the stickers we sell, all of that helps stretch that $39 a little bit further than it would go. But I still think $39 is a pretty good deal.
I think it is too. But now here's something else, and I want to say for project people. The ARRL used to put out a series of CDs that had old QSTs in it, you know. And then, of course, if I turn around right now in my studio, we have four bookshelves that are just totally, completely full of QSTs. I mean,
yeah.
I think we probably have, well, I don't know. We're missing some, I'm sure. And I don't know how far back it goes, but it goes, there's like three or four different sizes of QST back here. But now, if you're a league member, You can access any QST online, any project, anything you can remember from back when you were a kid. And you say, well, I remember when they put that in QST. Boy, I wish I could find the diagram for that. You can.
Yeah, it's really pretty neat. The scans that we had done to produce some of those originally produced on CD-ROM have now been all incorporated into a web engine that allow members who have access to the ARL website to browse the QST archive online. And members can access, I believe, December 1915 all the way through December 2005 QST right from their armchair. And then those members who have opted into the Diamond Club program, which is a contributors level of membership, they get some of the more current issues of QST delivered that way. But generally, most members access 1915 all the way through 2005. You can search articles by author name or by the year you were licensed or by particular keywords, and it's quite an accomplishment. And I think in the next years, you're going to see us move more digital content to the web to serve members of the organization. I think you'll see improvements in the quality of the digital publishing that we make available online. And this archive is just kind of a first step.
Well, yeah, I think that is really cool. And you know, you can get lost on there. I mean, you can.
I think the first thing I did was I wanted to look to see if I could see my first radio in one of the old issues of QST, and then what was going on in amateur radio when I first earned my license. And boy, I had fun looking through the World War II issues of QST, and then you know, any of the recent projects of the last 10 years, they're at your fingertips. It's great.
You know, something I'd have never noticed because I was always too busy looking at articles. But now, it seems to me I saw some of the old ads in there, too.
That's right. I mean, the archive retains the layout of the original page of the magazine, so all the ads are in there, too.
So, I was going to tease you when you said that they had updated the handbook. I was going to ask you if there was any Hallicrafters ads in the back of that handbook this year.
Not so much.
But let's talk about some other benefits from being a member. Now, you know, a lot of folks don't think about all the different aspects of it. They, you know, they think of getting QST, or they may think, well, yes, we're supporting amateur radio, but there are some other definite benefits, and why don't we get into just a little bit of that so that folks understand it's a broader scope than just subscribing to a magazine.
That's right, and that is an important distinction. When you join ARL, you haven't just subscribed to QST. You've become a member of an association that really provides a voice for these days for close to 155,000 members of the amateur radio community. And QST is clearly one of the most popular benefits, but it's also that relationship that we have with all of our members once a month. The QST archive and the online website provide additional services. There's also a number of really fantastic e-newsletters that you can subscribe to related to DX, contesting, the Amateur Radio Emergency Service, the weekly ARL letter. These are all great ways to keep up with what's going on in your particular interest area of amateur radio. But there's also some very hands-on services that you can get access to as a member of the league. One of the most popular is the Technical Information Service, and that's a group of staff here associated with our laboratory that help members on nearly any type of technical interest or question, technical difficulty or research or whatever they need in the technical field from amateur radio. Sometimes that's research done to find an old article or a copy of a schematic. But sometimes it's also about, geez, you know, I put my antenna up on the roof. I think I followed all the instructions. I got the radials all set up properly. I've done this, that. But, you know, I'm still having a problem with something. I'm not getting out. Neighbors are complaining about RF on the TV. And sometimes talking that through with one of our technical information staff is very helpful.
I know that the other thing, too, that I want to say, and that is, you know, keeping in touch with other hams and all the activities that are going on. QST, when it comes out and you get it, even though, you know, everybody is very, very hot to online things today, it's really handy to be able to have this in print form and to be able to see them.
I don't think the print edition of QST is ever going to go away. First of all, it's a membership organization, so even though your interest area might only be very singular, it's important that you know what's going on in all the other aspects of the association as well. This is where we find our strength in numbers when we go to Washington or to state legislators' offices and leverage amateur radio to the forefront of positive legislation or positive benefits. So it's nice to be able to wrap ourselves in that 155,000 members with one voice, who know what's going on in all aspects of the amateur radio service. And at the same time, we use QST and some of our e-newsletters and aerial publications to develop the individual and unique interests of the radio amateur.
Well, something else that maybe folks don't understand, too, and that is, if you join, and let's say that your wife is also a ham, and maybe you have children that are hams, there's a family plan. See, I take advantage of the family
That's
plan.
That's right. Family membership is a steal. You share the magazine, but for an additional $8 per family member, you can sign up everybody in the household. So if you've got one paying member at $39 and two harmonics in the household at $8 each, that's a great way to share all the benefits of ARL membership in a household without paying the full $39 price for each person. There's also a youth rate, and we have one of the more interesting youth membership rates for an association. Somewhere along the lines of the history of the organization, they decided that the youth that would be able to be eligible for that rate would be the ones that have a ham radio license, and that they're the oldest licensed radio amateur in their household. So if you're an 18-year-old or a 15-year-old and your parents haven't earned their license but you earned yours, you're eligible for a $20 reduced fee membership.
Oh, that's very, very cool.
That includes QST and all the other benefits that come with it. There's also some really neat additional affinity benefit programs that come with membership. These days, just like a lot of associations like AARP and other big national associations, we have a lot of buying power when we're members together. So we offer a ham radio equipment insurance plan to protect against damage to your amateur station or antennas or mobile gear from just about anything, lightning, theft, flood, a tornado, whatever. We also have a MetLife Auto, Home, and Renters insurance program, and the popular ARL Visa card, which goes to support ARL programs and services by returning a percentage of all purchases back to the organization.
Well, that's very cool. And you were talking about the insurance. You know, I'll tell you something today, and don't take me wrong, but I guess I don't have a whole lot of love for insurance companies because of the problems that I have had with just, you know, little things. I mean, no big things, but even just little things, getting a claim turned in. You don't have any idea. You have to really almost be an attorney to go through your homeowner's policy to find out what they exclude, what they'll cover, what they won't cover. And you may find, much to your amazement and shock, that if some catastrophic thing happens and you lose ham gear, or you have a lightning strike or something that comes in, you may find you have no coverage at all, you know, on the homeowners. And at least this policy that you folks are offering are specifically for the replacement of a radio should a rock fall on your house, you know.
Yeah, that's a really good one too. And now that we also offer the MetLife Auto and Home Insurance, that's kind of an interesting one too. You know, we've had a number of members who have long been MetLife Insurance customers who have said, geez, when I saw that the league was also, I called back MetLife and I asked them, you know, I've been a customer of you all for 10 years, but I'm also an ARL member. And many of them have reported back that that's caused an additional savings on top of their current policies, in some cases up to 20%. So it does pay to be a member, and sometimes that pay can be something like saving more than $39 a year on your car insurance.
Well, yeah, you know, I guess the thing of it is, if you think about hams, as a, you know, we're a group of people, but we're also a stereotype, like it or not. We're probably a far better risk when it comes to those kind of things than the average person on the street. I mean, I'm just going to say that that's probably the case. I may be wrong, but
that's right. We're not an avocation of appliance operators. You know, we're people who take a lot of pride in setting up a technical equipment properly and caring for that equipment properly. And I do think, in fact, that does make us a lower risk than say just the general population. And our relationship with the Marsh Affinity Group, for many years, that offers the Ham Radio Equipment Insurance Plan is a very good one. In fact, not just individuals, but amateur radio clubs sometimes will insure their equipment with the ARL Equipment Insurance Plan, affiliated ARL radio clubs around the country.
Well, sir, I want to thank you so much for coming on board with us and talking. I guess we've kind of run the gamut, you know, and talked a little bit about everything that the league has as far as, of course, you know, we haven't talked. One thing we haven't mentioned is, you know, the T-shirts and hats and other things. What else can you, you know, what there? I'm sure there's some coffee mugs and things, but Christmas is going to be coming up shortly. What kind of stuff?
Hey, well, you know, watch over the next couple of weeks for the new ARL holiday ornament, and I think we'll have some. We'll probably have some incentives where you can get that holiday ornament for free based on a certain purchase. So that's some insider information that I don't think anyone else knows. So now your listeners can watch for the ARL holiday ornament. But you know, we take a lot of pride in personalizing things with our amateur radio call signs. And the league has some great partnerships with a number of vendors of official ARL merchandise that'll print your call sign on a polo shirt with the league diamond on it. We've got some nice coffee mugs, and if there's a Elmer or someone special in your amateur radio community that you want to recognize with a plaque or award, we've got some really nice customizable awards that have some great amateur radio artwork on them. And all you have to do is type into an online form the call sign and pop your credit card number in, and away the plaque is off to you. So there's a lot of fun things, but you know, most importantly, you know, we're happy to see folks come to us for publications and membership, but we also want people to be very active in amateur radio, and we think that ARL members are among the most active members of the amateur radio community. So keep sending them our way, Ted, and we'll do our best to advance their interests.
Well, I thank you so very much and appreciate your time with us on the air. I'd like to have you back, though, at some point, and at that time, I'd like for you to kind of give us your biography. Tell us a little bit about how you got into the amateur radio service, what captured your interest originally, you know, and kind of your timeline. That's always interesting.
That's great, Ted. I'll enjoy that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions?
Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position.
go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton.
At QSO, we've got a new prize closet and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL, and we'll look.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of QSO. Be sure and listen again on Thursday for a repeat of this show. And, of course, we'll be back next week on Tuesday with more QSO. And a special thanks to our guest, Steve Mendelson, W2ML, and Bob Interbitson, NQ1R. Once again, thank you for listening to QSO.
It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing right now.